Justice Committee, you'll come to order. Take your seats if you are not seated yet. There is a quorum. We'll move to the minutes. Representative Doty, will you move the minutes from March 21st, 2007?
So move, Madam Chair.
Any objection? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Approved. Junkie?
Yes.
Junkie's bill is House File 2924.
42.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move House File 2942 and ask it to be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Is there an amendment that you would like to attach now or not?
No.
No? Okay.
Well, yeah. I have a verbal amendment.
Okay.
To get it in the shape on line 1.15, after bison, comma, put in sheep, comma.
No.
Forgot the ever popular sheep. So if you want to vote on that, then that would take care of that.
All those in favor of the oral amendment?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
All right. Madam Chair and Committee, this is House File 2942 is the Livestock Investment Grant Program. And basically, this is what you've known in the past as the dairy investment tax credits, livestock investment tax credits, and other formats over the last 3 years, I believe. We've never quite made it to the finish line as a tax credit, but we did find out that, lo and behold, as a grant program within the Department of Agriculture, a couple things happen. Number one, the best part of it is we never have to go to tax committee again. So that's a good thing for us, and we control what goes on. But number two, we did find out it works. For those of you that remember special session that we had for drought and flooding, when we did the flood relief package, we actually inserted Livestock Investment Grant Program down there in case someone needed to upgrade or redo or rebuild their feedlot or their animal facility, livestock facility. And we actually sent some money out using this program from the Department of Agriculture. Now, that program sunset February 1st, along with the rest of the flood relief program, but the fact is we did use it. It was a nice test, I think, and we understood that we could do it as a grant program, basically laid out as you go through the bill, and you'll see Representative Erdahl's bill afterwards. It's the dairy bill, but it's laid out essentially the same as you've seen for the last number of years. It's there's a limit to the amount of money you can get back as a grant. It's over a 10-year period of time. There's certain things that qualify for it. Again, everything is pretty similar to what you've seen as you read through the bill, and we're certainly open to suggestions if there's ways you want to improve it. But the big thing is with the bill is we want to get this into statute this year. Whether we have money or not, we realize it's not a finance year. If I can find in our committee, our finance committee, if we can dig and find some money to put towards it, we will, to get an earmark and to get it started. But more importantly, we'd like to codify this in statute this year, so next year when we move into a finance cycle, we don't have to sit and argue again about the language and where it's at and who's going to do it. It'll be there. All we have to do is appropriate the money, and obviously the governor and his folks can put it into their planning process for next year too, which actually starts this summer and fall before we're back. So we'd like them to realize it's out there and available for them too. I draw your attention to one area, which certainly I will ask the committee to weigh in on a policy standpoint, but it's actually more of a fiscal issue, and certainly the finance committee will weigh in too, If you have any ideas today, though, we're opening the list. And on line 2.30, we have set a there's a maximum level, $500,000 at 10%, and that's down below what you get back. But we also set a de minimis when we did this last year at an improvement of $40,000. Now, basically, here's what we're looking for, and I don't know what the right number is. We're looking for a number that means you're making a serious investment in the future of that livestock facility, that you are planning for you or your family or your kids or someone to be there for 5, 10, 15 years. And we want you there as an agriculture committee and as the state of Minnesota. So we think there's some minimum level that indicates that kind of investment. Now, $40,000 was picked, as redoing a tie stall barn into a parlor setup, et cetera, would probably run in that neighborhood. However, I think you could do it for less money. So, is that limit $10,000? Is it $20,000? Is it $30,000? I don't know the answer to that. I've asked people to bring me their ideas and their suggestions, but I would suggest this, that there is a de minimis level, because you could literally, without that, go to a farm auction, buy a used bin for $100 or $300, bring it home and say, I'm using it for my dairy or my cattle operation, and apply for the credit. And that does nothing to necessarily enhance the longevity of that operation. And that's really what we're after, is you investing for the long term. And if you're doing that for the long term, then we're willing to partner with you as a state, is what we're saying. So I just draw your attention to that as a focal point of discussion now and as we move into finance. And I'm certainly open to the committee's suggestions on that. And Madam Chair, that's the bill. I know you have some people from the department that would like to weigh in, since they're the ones that will be administering it, and give their okie-dokie or whatever heads up they want to give to, and then I'd stand for questions.
Representative Foles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have two questions. I'll start with the first one. I agree with you on the $40,000. Where that came from, I don't know. The problem is that for one farmer, $5,000, I mean, they spend more than that just on repairing tires in a year. And the next one, that's their total income for the year. Is it possible to have a two-tier approach where it's, a much lower number or 10% of their gross sales for the year, something along that line, so that it fits all sizes of farms? Because I certainly think $40,000 is appropriate for some, but $4,000 is a much more appropriate number for others. So I'd like to throw that out as an option to take a look at that, because I think that we need to come up with something other than $40,000. I think that's just too high.
And certainly, Madam Chair and Representative Post, that'd be a good idea too. What I'm asking is people bring me that information then. So that what is the average farm income, or what would 10% of that be? You have to be a full-time farmer. You have to qualify at a certain sales level, and is it 10%? I don't know. Again, you're throwing out numbers now too, which I agree with you. But which numbers do we throw out? And I don't know where the 40 came from either. I can't even remember back
okay.
then.
I'll try to bring you something on that in the near future.
And I'd ask research to help us out too. We've got capable staff that can find some income in the department and try and quantify that a little bit better.
The second thing that I want to bring up is the pasture development has always been in these previous bills, and it isn't in this bill. Was that an oversight, or is that an intentional taken out?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Faust, it wasn't in last bill that we did. However, I'm not precluding it. Again, I would ask as a policy question on the pasture development. I have no problem with the real estate aspects of it, fencing, watering facilities, feed bunks, anything you may be putting out there with your pasture. The only part I would question is the seed and fertilizer type things that are not permanently affixed to the land, so that number one, there's no recoverability of them. Number two, I think you open up a door then when you pay for or give credit back for seed and fertilizer and chemical, et cetera, for development of the pastures, because we also grow corn for livestock and we grow soybeans for livestock. And at what point then are we focused in? I mean, maybe they want to go to no-till corn too for their operation at the same time, or we're going to help them with that too. And again, so I'd be willing to add, and certainly happy to work with anyone on the real estate end of the pasture development. I think we should talk that through. And again, I see an amendment in the file from Erdahl. He didn't think that through like I did, because he's got feed and feed in there, I think. So, but we can talk to him about that later. But I think the real estate, pasture, surveying costs, putting in a feed bunker or a water tank or whatever you're putting out there, certainly, I think, is appropriate.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Junkie, I'd just like to commend you for bringing this forward. You know, you and I have worked together on these things now for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I think. And, you know, I'll be offering a bill that's somewhat similar with a little different take on it. But the important thing is that this time we finally get something through that doesn't have to get lost in taxes or in a veto somewhere, and that you know, we can actually make some progress in helping agriculture and dairy.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too would like to commend you for this work, getting this out of the tax committee, and something our farmers can count on is a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd also like to weigh in with Representative Faust's opinions. As you know, my district has many small farms that a small amount of money can make the difference between keeping that staying in the family or disappearing and getting merged, and that doesn't fill our stores and our churches out there. So thank you for being excellent starter on this, and look forward to seeing it finished.
And like I said, Madam Chair, Representative Doty, we are willing to work with you and Faust and anyone else on what should that de minimis be, and what can we base it on? We should base it on something, you know, not just pick numbers out of the air.
Are there any other questions?
Maybe you want to get the department up here and see what they have to say.
Testify?
I think they're on the list. I didn't put them on there.
Yes, sir.
Oh, here they come.
Representative
Zuchowski. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Junkie, being new to the committee, I don't have the background, and I didn't get the chance to really talk to you about the details. Have you considered a tax credit instead of a grant in the past? And what, maybe I know I should ask that question.
Representative Erdahl.
Representative Zuchowski, it started as a tax credit, and that's what Wisconsin has, and actually, the governor had it in his budget as a tax credit at $9 million. But we can never get it to the tax committee. And it doesn't make any difference if it's a Republican or a Democrat who controls the committee. They don't like tax credits. Now, it actually did make the bill last time, the tax bill, as a grant of $500,000. And as part of that tax bill, it was vetoed, not because of that, but because the governor has some other problems. And so that's why we've now evolved into grant programs, because we can't get it through the tax committee. And also, by doing it this way, we avoid the tax committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Zuchowski, this will be administered in the Department of Agriculture, probably with their rural finance group. So we have finance people there that administer a lot of programs that we're comfortable with. And in fact, they're the ones that helped us develop this language, so it would work for them too. And that way, really, it's only the Ag Policy and Finance Committees that have to deal with this in the future, and we don't have to jump around the legislature like Representative Erdahl said and doom our fate ultimately.
Welcome. Can you state your name, Quinn Cheney? And
thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Quinn Cheney with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I really don't need to testify here on this today. As Chair Junkie also said, we have worked together with him and to provide him some guidance on how the language could be structured so that we can administer it at the department, and we don't have any problems with this legislation.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Cheney? Thank you. Minnesota milk producers, are they wanting to? There they go.
Here they come. And while they're coming, I will tell you there's a letter in your file from the Minnesota Association of Co-ops that they provided. They don't need to testify, but they provided written testimony here, too.
Welcome. State your name for our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob LaFave. I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. I don't think it's any secret that Minnesota Milk supports this piece of legislation. We want to thank Representative Junkie and all the other co-authors for putting this effort forward. And while it doesn't have its, you know, it's expanded beyond its original intent, focusing on dairy, we're still appreciative that it certainly still does include dairy. Rather than talking all about the economic benefits and environmental benefits of dairy reinvestment and modernization and what that means to the state of Minnesota, I think I'll just go directly to the question about the $40,000 mark from our perspective as a grassroots dairy farmer organization, which is who we are, dairy farmers. There was a recent article in Midwest Dairy Business, a well-known professional dairy publication. Obviously, that focuses on the upper Midwest. And this one particular article that I pulled out from it, the title said, "What Can I Get for $1 Million?" And the article uses data that was developed by Dr. David Campbell from the University of Wisconsin. He's considered an expert in low-cost dairy modernization, if you will. And in this piece, Dr. Campbell concludes that you could build one 170-cow dairy operation from the ground up, brand new. Actually cost just a little bit over $1 million. He was $3,000 over budget. So for $1 million, you could get a 170-cow dairy operation. That does not include the cows. Now, this is obviously the investment grant program is set up that we'll be able to use more efficient use of funds by reinvesting in existing operations. So as our next witness here, Randy Pepin with the Todd County Extension Service, will explain a little bit more about what's been happening in the countryside and perhaps shed a little bit more light as well on this on the de minimis amount. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
So, Madam Chair,
your name for the record. So
Randy Pepin. I'm a Todd County Extension Educator. With
you does a great thing. Job, by the way.
Thank you. I guess my address today is specifically that we just recently we had a couple of seminars in Central Minnesota on the subject low-cost parlors. One was in Long Prairie, Minnesota, in Todd County, and the other was in Avon in Stearns County. And it's just about that, the subject matter, and I'll get into that just momentarily here. I just wanted to add that before I even start to say that I feel that this type of modernization on today in the state of Minnesota is crucial, I really feel, for the survival of dairy in Minnesota. Just as a reminder, and I realize I'm speaking to the choir, but just how important dairy and agriculture is to the state of Minnesota. Us being the sixth largest agriculture state in the country, we're the sixth largest dairy state in the country also. Dairy has a tremendous impact on, a positive impact on the economy of the state of Minnesota and rural economy. Our financial numbers, of course, are all taken from back in 2006 before our, as you all know, the change of our commodity that had happened about 17 months ago made a huge change. But using old numbers, the direct relationship of our dairy industry is $1.25 billion per year. That's direct. If you look at the ripple effect of the dairy industry, you know, because the dairy farmers spend a lot of money and for supplies, and the so-called ripple effect with the amount of cows we have is in excess, with old numbers, of over $7 billion to our dairy, to our Minnesota economy. This is huge. And so with with such an industry having such a huge impact in the state of Minnesota, is why I feel, many of us feel strongly that we need to modernize our system. What brought about this whole process of parlors? Just kind of go back a little bit in time. When dairy started in our whole industry in our state, people were milking in stall barns. They had 5, 6, 10 cows milking by hand. And that continued to grow into the after the war, and people with electricity expanded. They had 20, 30, 40 cows still in stall barns. Served us well during that time. But now as the dairy industry is affected by economy just like any other business, and in order to continue to survive, they need to continue to have a few more cows. And as these people have milked 60, 70, 80, and 100 cows in these tight stall type barns, it's become a challenge. As I talk to people, talk to dairy producers, the number one concern that they have is their personal health. Is that when they're milking numbers like I just described, anything 60 to 100 cows a day in these barns, is just takes a tremendous toll on their body, their knees and their back. So the number one driving force is making these people consider having some alternative way of milking cows. Then the number two is time efficiency, because in a pet parlor system you can milk cows faster. It's better, much better health for the farmer, and certainly it's better on the cows. In the past, so often their options have been presented to them as spending $250,000 or more for modernization, which fits quite well into a fairly large farm, but for somebody that's milking 50, 60, 70 cows, this is quite excessive. When we presented what we have as an option, and we did have, as Bob just mentioned, Dr. David Pommel from the University of Wisconsin over for our seminars, and it's a process of remodeling a present stall barn into a pit parlor with a crowd gate, just into a proven system that does work, is efficient, and cost effective. The amount of dollars is going to vary depending on what the present building is, what their needs are, and where they want to go. So that there's no definitive amount, but the amount, you're usually going to spend at least $20,000, and it's probably going to be closer between $40,000 to $50,000 by the time they finish up, and this is for the parlor and crowd gate. But the key point is that this is something that if they're a profitable farm at 60 cows, it's something that they can see that they can accomplish, whereas $250,000 or more is really not even an option. So what is a low-cost parlor? Then essentially say we're taking an existing tie stall barn, remodeling it, and putting a pet parlor and crowd gate area into that barn. Far more effective than building a new facility. We already have a milk house attached. We already have water. We already have a manure system. We have, in most cases, a structure that's sound that we can modernize and remodel and use for a number of years. Also, with the designs that have been, that the extension service has come up with, we can use straight pipes, so that many farmers with their own welding abilities or other people they can get a hold of can weld these things together without having to bring in high cost materials and labor. Part of the reason for keeping the cost down. In the end, it's just something that's doable. It works. These parlors are out there. It's not an experiment. They are out there. They do work. And then there's other, additional things, considerations in the process. The parlor is the one key point that these people see that, oh, I can do this. But it does force them to consider other things. They have to have a place to put the cows, because in many cases right now, the cows are in these barns. They have to consider, well, are we going to go to a freestall barn? And then do we use mats or do we use sand? Are we going to go with a bedding pack? Is it going to be compost or is it going to be conventional? Or is it going to be outside? Then there's other considerations with finance, the farm organization, etc., which is all, in our part of our education process with extension is to work through this. But still, as far as your concerns about the $40,000, in most farms that are full-time operations right now, And if they're looking at doing a parlor and any supporting remodeling with that, we certainly will be in that category, I feel. I think it's in my mind, quite adequate. So, in summary, I just want to say thank you for an opportunity to speak to you today, and I encourage you to consider this. I really do think it's key and important for our industry to survive and to grow. And along those same lines, anything else that you could look at in the agriculture sense is making our state a agriculture-friendly state, be it by regulations or other things, would certainly enable us to be able to move along and with this great industry. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Pepin? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. Try to keep this pretty brief. Here to speak basically in favor of House File 2942 and appreciate the work Representative Junkie and Erdahl have done over the years. I would note, too, since we've been working on this, you know, Minnesota's lost over 1,000 dairy farms just in the time this bill's been considered. I was looking at some of my statistics today. And in the same time, too, we've also seen New York put a $30 million grant program in. So if we're looking at other states with similar cow numbers, looking at what are they doing to try to, you know, put new investment. And I'm speaking specifically on dairy. I know it's a livestock credit, but I think a lot of us know that we're trying to help the dairy industry because of some of the needs they have. But New York put in a $30 million grant program last year. Wisconsin, who this was originally modeled after, their credit, and I'm passing out a sheet. This is 2005. You can see that there was an $11 million credit, and I believe 2006, we're just getting the numbers because you're always a year behind on the taxes, will be somewhere around $18 million that they're putting in and paying back to their dairy farmers in a tax credit. So I think that's important to consider when we're looking at trying to do something or have tried to do something in the last couple of years. Our policy set by our members, working with a dairy committee that's been growing and really glad to see that. We're considering several things and talking also about Representative Erdahl's bill too coming up here, that we have a little under 5,000 dairy farms now in the state. Nearly 4,000 or so milk 100 cows or less. And I note that about a little over 2,000 still make milk 50 cows or less. And so, you know, trying to decide, too, who we're trying to help here, keep in mind, you know, some important things. So I appreciate the comments by Representative Faust and Doty. And spoken with Representative Junkie and appreciate he's been really good about trying to decide what the appropriate number. One concern with the bill is the 40,000 points. If you look at this sheet in Wisconsin, for example, the average credit, and there's a lot of factors in here and what pays in, the average credit is $1,800, and they have the 10% credit, so that would be an $18,000 investment. So, and then you can kind of look and see, you know, some of that. The other thing that's interesting on there is 50,000, 77% of the credit was filers of income of 50,000 or more. It also takes into consideration if you have a spouse that has off-the-farm income. So there's a lot of factors in there. But bottom line, in talking to the Wisconsin Department of Revenue, their grants are anywhere, you know, in that $15,000 to $18,000 range is the upgrade. So I just wanted to make that point. Also visiting some of you that were on the committee 2 years ago, remember Van Palgen from down southeast Minnesota, retrofit dairy barn, and in talking to him, you know, he can say you can do good retrofits sometimes for $5,000. Sometimes it's $200,000. So he retrofits in Wisconsin a lot, and he said the average is somewhere around $20,000 or $25,000 for a retrofit. So I urge you to consider a much lower number on that. Our policy actually supports no limit, but I understand some of the bookkeeping and some of the good reasons that Representative Junkie has suggested for that. And I thank you for your consideration for this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Peterson? Welcome, Mr. Pat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Pat. My wife, Julie, who's with me today, and I own and operate a fourth-generation family farm where we raise corn, soybeans, and boys. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for and all committee members for this opportunity to appear. I'm President of the Minnesota Farm Bureau. I'll keep my remarks brief. Farm Bureau, along with Farmers Union, as was already mentioned, supports passage of House File 2942, authored by Representative Junkie. We want to thank Representative Junkie for his leadership and both all members on both sides of the aisle for your support of animal agriculture in Minnesota. So passage of a livestock investment grant program is good for Minnesota livestock farmers, it's good for all Minnesota farmers, and it's good for all of Minnesota. A grant program based on investment in livestock will assist us as farmers in improving animal care and safety, upgrading and modernizing facilities and equipment, and improving the manure handling and storage. Minnesota livestock generates income, business activity, and jobs. In my written testimony, we talk about the amount of jobs and what it brings to the table. This committee is well familiar with that. But I would remind you that this activity helps support our rural schools, our churches, and our entire rural community. Passage of this grant program will help promote bringing our next generation back to the farm. Now, more livestock means more people in rural Minnesota. More families equal more kids in our rural schools, and more families using our local businesses on Main Street. Also, it's very timely today. We need to remember the Minnesota biofuels industry must have Minnesota animal agriculture. We need animal agriculture to utilize our co-products. You cannot be for value-added biofuels and against value-added animal agriculture. We must have both to be sustainable and profitable. This legislation is good for our environment. Raising livestock requires renewable resources, and by increasing livestock numbers, we'll increase the need for more pasture and hay in Minnesota. This is good for our Minnesota environment. I want to thank the legislators for including this program in last year's disaster bill and urge passage of House File 2942 to allow the participation of more Minnesota livestock farmers in this valuable program. Appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I would answer any questions if there are.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Papp? Thank you for being here. Mr. Falls?
Thank you. I just want to make one last comment. I want to compliment Representative Junkie for finding a way to get this passed without making you go through the tax committee. That's a great accomplishment, and that's great. This is a great bill. It'll be a great thing for Minnesota, and I'll get you those two minor amendments as soon as I can.
And Madam Chair, thank you. If there's no one else, before I renew my motion, I do appreciate the information. We have something to hang our hat on. This piece that Farmers Union brought us, where the average was $18,000, which, you know, and most are $15,000 to $18,000, kind of starts us on a way of at least justifying a number that's lower than 40. So I'd encourage people in the audience or members to bring any information like this so we can try and decide where we're going to set that number. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd renew my motion that House File 2942 pass out of here and head towards finance.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill has passed.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and members.
Finance. Representative Erdahl, you're next. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right now we have for consideration House File 2631. Would you like to remove your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe a delete all is
In your possession, I you move that first?
Mm-hmm. You need to move your bill first.
Move the bill first, then the lead off?
All
right. Got to get that straight. It's been a year, you know. Yeah, I move 2631 for passage and referral to the Finance Committee. Now I move the delete all?
Yes.
All right, now I move the delete all.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Yes.
Okay, thank you. We have struggled for about 5 years to find a way to assist our dairy industry. Representative Junkie has just presented a bill that is, as I said earlier, somewhat similar to this, a little more expansive. Once again, I do applaud his efforts on this. My bill is focused more on dairy. It's not that I oppose having all livestock included in this. In fact, last year I did have two bills. One was an investment tax credit for dairy, and another was an investment tax credit for all livestock. However, this year, basically, there's not much money. The governor's budget of a year ago had $9 million for this. And when I asked the governor's office what we could do this year, basically, the governor's office said there was no new money, find your own. And so, within agriculture, we looked around a little bit and discovered the methane digester program was being underutilized. Right now, there's $250,000 left in it, and so we're going to, in this legislation, basically move the digester money from one part of agriculture into another, into RFA, and make it eligible for a modernization dairy loans. And you have on the bill listed the qualifying expenditures for this, and included in that is the methane digester. So technically, you could still access some of that money for a methane digester. This funding, again, would be an RFA, where the subject to the criteria that RFA gives their grants by. This is a matching grant program. Grants are available for any amount up to $40,000. So some of the conversation about lower amounts of money would be permissible under this. For example, if you needed $10,000 or had a $10,000 project, you could get a $5,000 grant from RFA if you had the $5,000 as well. I visited Barnes this year, actually Representative Heidgerken, in Stearns County, where there are more cows than there are people, brought me onto a farm that had just retrofitted their tie stall into a parlor operation, cost about $40,000 the way they did it. And so again, $20,000 grant, $20,000 matching, they could do the retrofit, which, as has already been indicated, is a pretty, I think, important thing to maintain our industry. Now, last week, I heard that there were 13,000 more dairy cattle in Minnesota than there had been the year before, and that's a good thing. We need more livestock. But what is concerning about that is the fact that we still lost 254 dairy farms last year. So what does that mean? It means these larger mega dairies are adding, or there are some incremental gains in some other smaller farms, but we're still losing dairy farms. We have to do something to address this particular problem that we have. And this bill is focused on dairy for this year. Again, I'd like to see a larger pool with more farms and all agriculture and livestock in it, so But right now, it seems to make sense to me that since this bill has $250,000, if there are other sources of money that we can find, we'd be glad to find ways to put that into this. But we have a small pool of money and a shrinking industry. And I want to focus that small pool of money on the dairy industry. I'm somewhat reluctant this year to try to include, you know, all of livestock, all of agriculture into this very small pot of money, because I think that we can be more effective in the usage of the money just with dairy. I think that basically is it. Or the one point, also this is, I just heard we have 400 or 4,000 cows of 100 or less, and this bill targets farms 100 or less. Concludes my my comment.
Do you have any testifiers?
Anybody who wants to talk to us can.
Anyone in the audience want to testify? Any one of the members want to speak?
Thank you for bringing this bill forward as well, and I like the fact that it has no bottom cap to it. Although my only concern is that with up to $40,000, and we've only got $250,000 that we found so far, and we basically six people could take the whole thing, and it's allocated based on first come first serve basis. I don't know how else you'd do it, but I guess those are my only concerns with the bill, and I hope that we can just find some more money for it, because I do like the concept. Other than that,
thank you, Representative Faust. Yeah, we use whatever the criteria that is used by RFA to grant the loans, and as you saw the grants, as you saw in most projects, the amount is much less than that. I don't anticipate everyone jumping in and trying for $40,000 in grants. It would be much smaller numbers.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bergall, thank you for your realization that it is about the number of farmers and not just about the number of cows. That's critical with the small towns that you and I deal with. And also for your efforts for this over the past several years. I know this is a project near and dear to your heart.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to
speak? Madam Chair, maybe this question's for you or Representative Erdahl. What if we pass two bills out here? We've got, you know, plausibly two competing bills. What can we expect at that point?
I believe that they both go to finance, correct?
Who's going to make the decision? Which one's better makes most sense for the long term? Because, I mean, this is something we're writing into law. Maybe there for future funding allocations, too. Who's going to make that call?
Representative Dunkey.
Thank you for that question, Representative Sikowski. And you will learn as we go along that there's a lot of bills that will be the same in a lot of different committees. And basically, number one, the chairman decides which bills we'll hear and move forward. And number two, the committee decides what form they move forward in. So we'll all have that say. We will sit down in finance committee both before committee, during committee, and probably after, and decide which pieces. If we like some of Erdahl's stuff, and he's got some good ideas here, certainly we will include that in my bill, or vice versa in his bill. We just decide which one moves, but we'll put one together that'll move out of the committee.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
In other words, one other or a combination thereof.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would just like to also weigh in on this. Both of these bills, I think, are important not only to the farm entities themselves, but also to our rural economies, because by having additional investment capital available, it will not only, you know, generate the livestock production, but it'll also aid in employment for the ancillary workers, the contractors that are going to help build these new facilities and so forth. So I commend both Representative Erdahl and Junkie for bringing these important bills forward.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl, you want to renew your motion?
Yes, I'll renew the motion to pass House File 2631 from this committee and on to finance.
Oh, yeah. We need to add as amendment.
As amended, okay.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Pass. Thank you.
Ready? Madam Chair, I'd move House File 2987 before the committee and recommend to pass and be referred to Commerce. Is that right? Commerce, the Department of, or Committee on Commerce. And Madam Chair, I have a DE1 amendment that I'd like to put on it right now, so we work off that. That will be in the form that I would like it to be at this point.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
All right.
Amendment passes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and I know there's other testifiers coming, I will briefly explain the amendment and the bill, and then we can certainly entertain questions and testifiers. Members of the committee Madam Chair, this is the B-20 bill. It's a bill, obviously, that we've been discussing since last summer. The governor talked about the bill out at Farm Fest, so it goes back to August, I believe, is when we first started popping up on the radar screen, and since then, the governor and the legislature have been trying to put together language along with the biodiesel task force. Farm groups, commodity groups, and others have all been weighing in on this as we try and get a development of a product here. Secondarily, I want to apologize to anyone who's thought that the bill we introduced was what we were going to start from. We had to get that in so we could get something moving, and obviously the DE amendment is somewhat different than what you saw on the website. So for those that were tracking there, be aware that this amendment is fairly, in some areas, significantly different, and we're starting from there. Members, I just remind you of the role you have played as a legislative body, along with the administration, in the history of Minnesota agriculture and as it relates to biofuels. Minnesota, as you know, is the first state to have the 10% ethanol mandate in place. And frankly, you all know that was probably what got this industry going back when we started it. I don't suspect we'd be quite where we're at today without the activities of the Minnesota legislature, and you can all be proud to be a part of that body. Since then, we have moved, as you know, to a B or to an E20, and we did that a couple years ago. I was fortunate; I got to serve on the conference committee of that particular legislation, and again, that passed in a bipartisan manner. Representative Finseth and Osmond, I think, were the chairs at that time in the House, and along with Senator Sams and Vickerman over in the Senate, we moved a B-20 mandate forward, and working again with the administration on that to get the signature. We were the first to do a B-2. Again, not waiting and not wondering what's going to happen. We've always taken the initiatives and moved forward, and we were the first state with a B-2 mandate. And so now what we see around the country is biodiesel, frankly, is most people are starting with a B-5 and going from there. So again, Minnesota took that first step on behalf of agriculture at the time, but now I think we're even moving beyond agriculture in a lot of this, and we can certainly discuss that as we move forward. So you all
are part of a very interesting history in Minnesota, and you know when you travel around the country to other groups, to seminars, to conventions, that Minnesota is certainly looked up to as a leader in the biofuels industry. Getting to the bill, Madam Chair, basically, again, this is a B20 bill. What it will do is incrementally move up to that B20 level by the year 2015. And if you look on page 1, you will see that incremental level stated there, and we'll get to that. The first section of the bill basically takes, if you're manufacturing biodiesel in Minnesota, and that's the intent here, is for people that manufacture in Minnesota, we not only meet, and we'll talk about it on page 2, the ASTM standard, which is a standard for all fuels that is set nationally, but we also, our producers want to meet the BQ9000 standard, and it's actually an additional standard above the ASTM. Again, Minnesota wants to make sure that their product, that people can have confidence in it, that it will work, that it's a superior product, and certainly talking to the manufacturers, the current manufacturers, they want to do this. This is not something that's being put on them. They're requesting that standard. We had talked about taking it out, but we think it adds a sense of stability and maybe even superiority that people can be confident in Minnesota manufactured biodiesel. So it's almost like a branding, if you will, that's what we adhere to. And I will tell you also, I'm chair of the Ag and Natural Resources Committee for CSG, and regionally we've been talking about trying to get regional, our states in the upper Midwest, to all go to a BQ9000, because we think it would actually enforce our quality of product up here. So we're actually working on it across borders at this time too. As you move down, you see the stated percentages. Again, I will tell you this, that it's a work in process. And as we move forward with this, we think the incremental, basically we're doubling until we get to the 15%. And I would ask the committee to consider this and think about it. None of this is engraved in stone other than, you know, along with the governor, the legislature, we want to get to a B20. That is the stated goal. But certainly, we wouldn't necessarily have to have a 15 if that causes a problem. We could certainly go from a B10 in 2011 to a B20 on May 1st of 2015. I don't think that would be a deal breaker for anyone. But again, we're taking a lot of these recommendations came out of the biodiesel task force that worked this year. That was their recommendation. But again, as we work with the distributors of the product, the retailers and others, if it's easier to not have to worry about switching products or tanks or doing other things, and we're trying to discover that, if we have to skip a step, say the B15, it wouldn't be a deal breaker. But again, that's a policy decision that certainly we can make. As you move down into the bottom of the page, another addition, I should back up a minute. The Biodiesel Task Force, which the governor formed, has been working for a number of years on biodiesel quality. Well, they also became kind of the de facto group that made some recommendations for the B20 when the interest was shown in that last summer. And so a lot of the things you see in here came out of that working group. However, there were some additional items. As we said, we met with commodity groups, farm groups, any interested parties have been in the office, and we're trying to address their concerns. Lines 120 through 122 actually makes the B20 effective only during the warm months, or what we consider to be the warm months in Minnesota. And again, that was put in there in response to some people that came in that wanted to make sure that people had a confidence in this product moving forward. Maybe by the time we get there, it will not matter, and we'll take that out. But at this time, we think it's a good safety valve to have in there to say we're only going to do this during the warm months. Similarly, you know, we switch from 1 and 2 diesel during those time periods, and certainly that's reflective of some of those concerns, whether proven or not. 123 and then on to page 2 basically says how we go from step to step. And again, these came out of the Biodiesel Task Force. we need to publish in the state register, so there has to be fair notice. And as you see, commissioners of Ag, Commerce, and Pollution Control all have to agree to publish. It's not one commissioner or the other. So we feel there's a broad group that's doing that. And then they have to meet the following specifications under there before they publish. In other words, there has to be an ASTM spec for that nationwide. Now, ASTM, American Society for Testing Materials, puts out the specifications for fuels that we burn through our vehicles. And if they don't have a spec for a B10 or a B15 or a B20, obviously we could not move forward. So we're putting, again, the onus that it's an approved fuel that's being used in our vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. Number two, supply. We want at least 50% of that anticipated demand to be available. We don't want to and produced in the state. This is similar to what we did in the B2 bill. Again, we certified that we could produce it, so we weren't relying on imported biodiesel. We knew that at least 50% of the supply could be produced within our own borders. And again, that's critical to shoring up the market need that we will see at that time. So again, that's nothing different, and we're carrying that forward as part of this. Again, infrastructure is number three. We don't want to just put it out there without our refiners and distribution points being able to handle it with the equipment, the tanks, the blending requirements, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to work with them to make sure they're ready to go with it. And then finally, all these commissioners must go back to the biodiesel task force and, you know, at least have the conversation with them that we're ready to go and that they're comfortable and that requires them to go do that. So we think we have a lot of protections in place as we move forward that this will be a good quality product and be ready to go. The rest of it, as you move through basically to the last page, is where the rest of the proposal comes. There is a money piece in here, and certainly we're looking for money. Part of that is in the Weights and Measures Division of the Department of Commerce, which is why this is going over there next. They have some excess fees they collect for inspection that we're going to try and capture and bring over, at least for the beginning appropriation, and that's why you see that Section 3. Section 4, then, is the appropriation to the Commissioner for Infrastructure Grants for our fuel terminals. Again, similar to what we did with ethanol and other things, we want to make sure that the infrastructure is in place and that we're assisting those folks if there needs to be some major monetary infusion to do that. The last piece you see there is educational activities. Again, as we listen to people, the ag educators and others in the state indicated, Madam Chair, you sit on that group, that education is always an important aspect to this, particularly when you're rolling out new and improved products. We saw that with past rollouts. It's good to make sure that folks are aware of what's coming and what it means to them. But certainly this also comes, I will tell you, a report is coming shortly from the NextGen board, which met all year. And part of that report you see, what you will see is an indication that we need to do a better job in education on all our renewable fuels in this state. So you're going to start seeing some educational activities, I think, show up in some of these bills based on the work that you and other task forces have done in the past. So, Madam Chair, that's the bill. Again, I don't think it's a mystery product. I don't think it's anything that anyone's unfamiliar with, and we've certainly had success. I will end with this. As I said, we started with agriculture, and it's in agriculture, but certainly I don't believe this or any future bill for ethanol or any other fuel will be solely agriculture. I've already talked to some people, said, well, can we grow enough soybeans to manufacture this much biodiesel? Probably not. But that's why we grow sunflowers and canola and other oil crops up in the Red River Valley. And that's why we're working on biodiesel from algae. As we speak at our own University of Minnesota, there are a lot of places where these future products will come from. So while it was great that it was corn and soybeans to start all this, as we move into the next generation of fuels, it could be a plethora of other sources for production, manufacture, and distribution of these types of fuels. And I think, again, it's very proper that the Agriculture Committee spearhead this, You all put it in your bill last year to have a 25 and 25 goal for all energy in this state. And this certainly, if we're going to really put some teeth in it, this moves us towards that final end point. So with that, Madam Chair, I will stop and certainly answer questions on the bill. But then I know the Commissioner or the Department of Agriculture, I know the Commissioner here, yep, he's in the front row. We want to be respectful of the testifier's time. So if you have questions for me right now, I'm happy to answer them. But I guess I'd prefer to get at least the Commissioner up first and then we could move forward, unless there's something that's really, really burning on them here.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairman Junkie, this is, of course, for all the reasons that we all know. Great bill, great idea. If we're going to reach 20% in 7 years, I think we have to be very careful that this language isn't limiting one of the sources, and we've been conversing here that maybe just have a conversation with Colby and maybe some others about the definition right off the start, that we're not wiping out some source we're going to need to hit 20%.
And Madam Chair and members, there is some talk in the federal energy bill and certainly for the renewable fuel standards that was set into place, mandated by the federal government and signed by the president. That mandate obviously is looking for other things to fill those voids, and we're going to try and match up more with the federal language. And certainly there's a difference in Minnesota law, and I think, Madam Chair, for you and this policy committee, it's something you need to look at, is the definition of biodiesel and biofuels versus renewable diesel and renewable fuels. There's a difference there, and that's a policy decision. Certainly, it's in some of the definitions here, but I think elsewhere in statutes too. And I agree with you that this committee, along with research and along with the department and other groups, need to understand how the different types of manufacturing processes of biodiesel versus renewable fuels, what that means, and how we go about crediting that or putting it into our policies. I agree with you.
Thank you. Commissioner Hugeson?
And while he's coming up here, Madam Chair, I just want to point out that, you know, this is, again, I mentioned it, but I think we don't have to mention enough that this is not a partisan issue, never has been. This is not a governor versus a legislature issue, never has been. We need everyone at the table to move these things forward for the good of Minnesota. That's why we're all here. It's not for anyone to, and by the way, most of you have signed on as authors, so I know you all have this on your campaign brochure, but that's not what this is here for. This is here for Minnesota, and I know the governor, as well as legislators around this table, are looking to see that we do the best thing for our economy and for our state, and that's why we're here. But I welcome the commissioner.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Junkie, thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to this issue. Frankly, this is a big step as part of the history of continuing the history of Minnesota being a leader in renewable fuels. It's something the state has done well all along the way. As Representative Junkie referenced earlier, Minnesota has become sort of a model not only for other states but actually even other countries as they look at what's going on in terms of focusing our attention and doing what we can to encourage as well as strongly encourage the use of renewable fuels. When you look at where biodiesel has fit into this whole situation, many of you may remember, if you weren't here yourselves, back in 2002 when this biodiesel bill was first passed. And there were some things about that were unique. And if you remember the discussion at that time, they actually considered doing it at 5% and then decided that in the interest of some unknowns to back off and only implement it at 2%, which, of course, the bill did. But the bill had a feature in it that said that the mandate would not take place until Minnesota was in a capacity of producing half of the biodiesel needed within the state. That occurred in the late summer of 2005. And so in September of 2005, we began the process that actually put this in place. Now, that first winter, we had a few problems. There's no doubt about it. And anybody that was around at that time know that remembers some of those incidents. But some steps were taken by the biodiesel producers, by the people that handle it, in such a way that when we look at what took place the second winter, and even this winter, things have gone much better. And so with that in mind, we feel comfortable with the idea of moving ahead to really go where we planned to go initially, but to actually go beyond that to incrementally raise it to the 20% by 2015. As Representative Junkie mentioned, Governor Pawlenty at FarmFest announced the idea this last year and suggested that we work on ways to see that come into place. We reactivated the biodiesel task force, which had been dormant for a few years, because that was put in place initially to help make that transition. And the biodiesel task force, and I won't get into the specifics of what was involved this time, because Kristen Weeks Duncanson, the chair of that task force, is here today, and she's going to talk on it as well. But initially it was to look at how do we bring all the players that are involved with the biodiesel issue, all the way from the producers to the distributors, the terminal folks, the truckers, all the groups that have an interest in this this issue, and bring them at the table to discuss what we could do. And so that group got together this time again and looked at what would be needed for putting Minnesota at a higher rate of usage than just the 2%, and ultimately to get us to 20%. And as the bill reflects that Representative Junkie has in here, this group will continue to play a major role in terms of doing the discussion. And I would suggest that they actually will be the ones that will drive when that next step is achievable. And while there are target dates in there for that occurring, the reason that there's some variance in there is to allow for those kinds of things that might be unanticipated. Will we, in fact, have enough supply to do it on hand? Will we have the technology that's needed? Do we have the federal requirements in place that allow us to move in that direction? Already, there are a number of engine manufacturers that will warranty their engines up to 20%, but not all of them do yet, and so there's some things that have to be done and worked on and to move in that direction. We currently produce enough biodiesel in this state so we could go to 8% without any additional increase in any kind of processing. So to go to 5% is not going to be any kind of a technical hurdle in terms of where we're going to go in that regard. But beyond that, of course, we're going to have to look at some additional input of feedstock of some sort to get to that particular issue. And contrary to what some of the naysayers are saying, I don't believe that this is going to be a issue that's going to cause environmental harm. In fact, we would argue that this is actually moving in a step of actually improving environmental quality for a lot of different reasons. What's interesting, I think, to note is that when this bill was first passed back in 2002, I think we would all agree that a major component of the bill was the intent was to help the farm price situation. It worked. We know where we are today, and there's some things that have dramatically changed. So why are we looking at increasing it even farther? Well, quite simply, at that particular time, oil prices were much less than $100 a barrel. And so while we're looking at still increasing the amount of the renewable fuels, I think it's being done more now for a national security issue than it is a farm issue. And so for those reasons, it's imperative that we be looking at this issue and other issues as Minnesota has done. That's part of the reason why a major focus of your session last year was dealing with renewable energy. This is but a small part of that whole equation, and it's something that we want to continue working on. The governor has likewise been very active in terms of his interest in this issue. He's chair of the National Governors Association this year, and for the first time in history any governor has ever made renewable fuels, renewable energy, the focus of his year-long tenure. And people in the past have tended to use education, government reform, and those kinds of things, but he's decided to use something practical as his means of showcasing what Minnesota has done and certainly what other states could do as well. So, Madam Chair, members, we appreciate what Representative Junkie is doing here in terms of carrying this legislation, because I think it certainly gives all of you an opportunity to be a major part in where we're going this year as we look at going ahead. You know, one of the other things that I just would reference as well, too, federal legislation this last year placed a very major emphasis on biodiesel also. In the energy bill that Representative Junkie referenced, there is a provision in there that requires the United States get to a point of using 1 billion gallons of biodiesel a year by the year 2012. So Minnesota will actually play a major role in helping the U.S. government achieve that level. So, Madam Chair, I think I'll stop at that point, and knowing that there's other people that will perhaps get into more specifics in some other area. But just thank you and the committee's interest in this issue, and look forward to working together with Representative Junkie and all of you as we take this next step in Minnesota's renewable fuels history.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the commissioner?
Thank you.
Kristen Week Dunston.
And why, Madam Chair, while she's coming forward, I just want to point out again, the reason we do this, the way we do it in Minnesota is, and I know if you're a free market person, it's not the way you want to go, but it's worked in our model, is where we create the market, and then people have the confidence. If we went to have created the B2 market, that was the confidence that the soybean folks in this state needed to build those biodiesel plants and have an assurance that there'd be a market for it once they were done. And in fact, it worked. And it worked without putting state dollars in, by the way. With ethanol, we actually put the producer payments in, too. We haven't had to do that with biodiesel because we've assured them the market, and the capital then follows in. And again, that's one of those questions that we wrestle with, but it's worked very well in Minnesota at this point in time.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kristen Weeks-Dunkerson, and since 2002 I've chaired the Biodiesel Task Force here in the state of Minnesota, and it has been an honor and privilege to do so. I would like to commend and applaud Mr. Junkie just today for bringing this bill forward. It is truly a step on our way to becoming, again, the model state for renewable fuels, and we're pleased to be a part of that. The task force was set up, as the Commissioner mentioned earlier, to help with the transition to the B2 legislation several years ago. In August, the Governor put forth a proposal for us to look at going to B20, and we were, again, pleased to have the opportunity to bring together all the stakeholders in the biodiesel industry and discuss issues that, or concerns surrounding that plan. One of the things that we did was talk about where we had been, and as the Commissioner mentioned, we did have a few hiccups with some cold weather properties. Those concerns were very much investigated and researched, and we were pleased that in this winter and most of last winter, we have not seen that problem happen at all. The task force spent the summer developing a systematic approach on how to get to B20, and I will say, too, that time and technology are definitely on our side as we move ahead. And if we look at where we were even 10 years ago, I thought methyl esters were Lucille Ball's upstairs neighbor, Ethel Mertz. Now we're talking about methyl esters over the dinner table like any other, ethanol and any other product in the renewable fuels industry. So we've come a long way in a short time, and I am assured by those folks that are in research and development of biodiesel as well as other renewable fuels that those strides will continue as we move forward, even more quickly than they have in the past. We were pleased, the task force was pleased to hand off the work we had done to the Next Gen Board in January, and also very pleased that Mr. Junkie has brought forth this proposal, which included many of the items that were discussed. I will tell you also there has been some concern about the southwest corner of the state not having product availability as we had hoped. Those things is promising with the market development in South Dakota, as well as working with our partners at Magellan, that we're working towards getting better product availability for that corner of the state. That has been something that has brought to our attention, and we're working diligently to improve that situation. With that, I will just say that there are a couple things that need to be looked at in the future as we go on. One of them is how to label the product at level, and also as new feedstocks, as the Commissioner mentioned earlier, there are new feedstocks coming available to make this product, and we'll want to make sure that the availability as well as the quality of those feedstocks are considered as we move ahead. With that, I will end my remarks. Like I said, it has been a privilege to be the chair of this task force, although at times not always as comfortable as one had wanted, but everyone needs a challenge. So I am pleased to be here today and would answer any questions if I could. There are also lots of technical folks in the audience here.
No questions, I guess. Thanks. You do a good job.
Thank you, and commend you again for your work.
We'll be talking to you.
Thank
you. Just Minnesota soybean. seducers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld, and I represent both the Minnesota Soybean Growers and the Minnesota Biodiesel Council. As I look around this room, there are a few cases that have been here for a few years, but most of you are fairly new to the process. And for those of you that are fairly new to the process, you didn't go through the biodiesel consultations that we had when this product first came before the legislature. At the time when biodiesel mandate was first brought before the legislature, there was an awful lot of people, and you can look out to my left here and you'll find an awful lot of lobbyists that don't necessarily represent agriculture that still have an interest in this issue. And so I'm sure that as the debate goes on, there'll still be continued discussions between everybody involved in it. But what I can say about it is, just to give you a little historical references, that when the bill first went through the legislature, it took 2 years for the bill to pass, and in addition to that, I think we went through 13 committees. Representative Junkie can remember those, I think 13 committees before it ended up. So it was something that, even though today a lot of people are kind of speaking of as though it's a known quantity, it wasn't at the initiation of that legislation, and so it has had an awful lot of review. There have been millions and millions of dollars of research put into this effort over a period of 20-some years, and that kind of thing continues to go on. But I guess, as the commissioner had indicated, the first year we had a few, sometimes we called them hiccups, sometimes they were real problems, but most of those things have been solved, along with the Biodiesel Council and others, including those who work with it throughout the system, that many of the issues that were talked about before have been solved. I'm not going to go much more into detail, but I just wanted to mention to the chair and a membership that we do have some expertise in the crowd here on technical issues if there was anything that were to arise along that way. So I think with that, just to indicate that the Minnesota Soybean Growers were ones that brought the original B2 legislation forward, and they continue to be interested and supportive in moving towards additional renewable energy. And so with that, I'd stand for any questions, or, as I said, we do have a lot of technical experts in the crowd that we brought along in case anybody needs some of that.
Any questions? Thank you. Jeff Hamill, Truckers.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm not Jeff Hamill, but he is with me. I'm John Houseladen, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association. Mr. Hamill is one of our members and also on our board of directors. I would also like to get some sort of overarching comments and turn it over to Mr. Hamill for the details. It's been a long time since we've sat before your committee. It was in 2002 when we first started this debate, and there are a lot of new faces. And it really was quite a battle. But what I am here to tell you today is that's not going to be a repeat. The Trucking Association has worked closely with the biodiesel industry over these ensuing, 6 years now. And we've learned a lot of lessons, and we've had a lot of discussions to the point where we've had the Biodiesel Council as exhibitors at our annual conference, so we continue to meet with them. And truthfully, a lot of the things that we raised early on did come to pass because the technology was new, but they've been worked through in many respects. The bill does reflect many of the concerns and solutions that we have voiced as part of the governor's biodiesel task force. We did have a member sit on that. And of course, like all task force recommendations, it isn't 100% what we recommended, but we do see a lot of our elements in there, and we do appreciate that, and we do see them coming through in the bill, and so we also thank the office for that. So let me be clear today, we can support a B5 mandate today. However, we must stand firm in our opposition to any automatic increases that go into effect without specific legislative action for each increase beyond B5. And with that, I'd like to introduce Jeff Hamill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Hamill. I'm Vice President of Prairie Line Incorporated, a small trucking company out of Shakopee, Minnesota. We specialize in dry bulk commodities hauling. We employ 30 drivers. We run 28 trucks in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Trucking companies rely heavily on high-quality fuel to ensure the livelihood of our businesses and, in turn, efficient and timely delivery of our goods. When fuel is in short supply or the quality is poor, the consequences can be very detrimental for my company and those relying on me. Such as the winter 2005-2006, diesel consumers across the state were literally brought to a halt by poor quality biofuel. And as you can understand, the thought of a higher biodiesel mandate causes me concern. Having said that, I also understand and appreciate the need to explore alternative fuel sources. The key to successful alternative fuels lies in the quality and quantity of assurances. In front of you is a set of our principles our industry developed to guide our response to efforts to move towards the B20 mandate. Successfully addressing these concerns will give our industry the comfort it will need to be willing partners in our state's bold venture towards quality diesel fuel replacements. Briefly, I'd like to discuss the following 8 issues addressed in any bill. Number 1, inclusion of an ASTM or Minnesota statutory specification for any blended biodiesel products beyond B5. Number 2, require the legislature to enact each and every increase in Minnesota's biodiesel mandate. While we appreciate the efforts to include approval by commissioners, we must stand firm in our position that such measures are not enough. Any increase above B5 should be affirmatively acted upon by the legislature. Number 3, performance and availability criteria must be met before enacting an increase in the biodiesel mandate. To achieve this, information verifying compliance must be supplied to the legislature by the appropriate agency when mandate increases are being considered, such as A, original equipment manufacturers, equipment warranty and compatibility with the suggested percentage of the biodiesel mandate. B, adequate B100 support to support the percentage increase suggested for the biodiesel mandate. And C, availability in all parts of the state, ensuring all terminals that sell fuel into Minnesota have biodiesel blending equipment. Number 4, allocate additional enforcement funding to the Minnesota Department of Commerce Weights and Measures Division to ensure all biodiesel standards can be enforced broadly and properly. And 5, implement a relief valve mechanism allowing the Commissioner of Commerce to suspend the biodiesel mandate if B100 becomes in short supply, out of specification, or dramatically raises the price of fuel at the pump. Number 6, pumps dispensing biodiesel blends that do not meet the ASTM diesel standard must be labeled to disclose the product's biodiesel content. Number 7, allow a variety of feedstocks and production methods to not only make higher mandate levels attainable, but to let the marketplace determine which diesel substitute performs best. And number 8, implement any biodiesel mandate in May, ensuring adequate operational experience throughout the marketplace during warm summer and fall months. And just a word on cost. The market will drive purchasing patterns. Trucking firms will purchase fuel outside of Minnesota if any mandate makes the fuel we need more expensive. According to our information, with current raw product costs, biodiesel is about 1 cent per gallon higher than petrodiesel. If B5 were in effect today, it would be 3 to 4 cents higher per gallon. I believe biofuels at levels beyond B2 can work, but without taking the necessary precautionary steps, we leave ourselves open to the same catastrophic failure we experienced 2 winters ago. The trucking industry looks forward to continued partnership with all stakeholders as we discuss the move to increase biodiesel levels in House File 2987. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for your time and I stand for any questions.
Representative
Foe. Thank you, Madam Chair. First question that I haven't heard brought up at all yet is, will truck manufacturers or pickup manufacturers honor warranty if we raise this to 5 or 10 or 15, 20%?
Madam Chair, Representative, again, I know that the Biodiesel Council has a pretty good spreadsheet that indicates what manufacturers warranty at what levels right now. I think the important thing to remember, though, is that engines today are really a system. You have the injection system, you have the engine itself, you have the aftermarket products due to federal regulations. So there, frankly, are a lot of OEMs that have to sign off on anything for it to really work in the whole system.
Okay, and that has not happened at this point?
Well, again, I don't think across the board, Madam Chair, you can say that B20 has that across the board.
Okay, thank you. Second question, most of the talk we've heard is diesel fuel. Is heating fuel included in this? No? Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Grosowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to remember your name again.
Jeff Hamill, John Houseladen.
Thanks, John. Mr. Hamill, Mr. Houseladen.
John and Jeff.
John and Jeff. Thank you, guys. As you look at it, I was listening to your, I was listening to number two on your list of eight, and looking at the bill, it looks like the bill does not conform really then with what you're looking at. I'm looking at, I'm reading here, subdivision 2B does not match number two on your list. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay. I guess that's really my question. Thank you.
Do you want to respond?
Madam Chair, no, I think we've covered it. I guess we have been talking to the author, and he certainly has agreed that he will continue to work with us as we address these issues, so we look forward to that discussion.
Okay. We only have a negative 1 minute left. go ahead.
Have you talked to your members about the idea of this mandate and what it would mean to their prices of fuel and operating and trucking? I suppose you haven't surveyed them, or have you?
Madam Chair, we have had a lot of discussion in the interim about biodiesel in general, and the principles we've laid out actually have evolved over a number of years, and our members helped us craft them, so I would say we're reflecting what they want.
Any other questions? Are there any other in the audience that would like to testify?
And Madam Chair, as they're coming forward here, Flint Hills, I would just point to a couple points that Representative Roskowski just said and that we heard. Two things on the price. We don't know what the price is going to be in 2015, and indeed biodiesel might be a lot cheaper than petroleum by them too. So will we ask for more for biodiesel to match petroleum at that time? So I mean, we have to consider both sides of this equation. The way the price of oil is, a lot of times ethanol and biodiesel are going to be made, they're going to be the low cost product. And then as far as the product itself, and I think most of you know this, we've been running B20 all in a lot of places in this state for a lot of years. So we know it works. Out in our area, we have farm distributors that have been mixing it in their back garage for some years now that our farmers run through their equipment in the summertime out there, because they're always like to burn their own product. So we've been supplying that. I believe B20 has been used also, if I'm not mistaken, at Voyageurs National Park for the last 10 or 15 years. Now, granted, they park their equipment inside at night in the wintertime and start it and run it out from there, but they are running a B20 up there, and they've done it for a long time. And I want to say City Minneapolis and or Hennepin County, one of those might have been running it too for a number of years, at least on a test basis. So we have a lot of good information on the product, Madam Chair, and I'll let her go here.
State your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Smith, and I'm with Flint Hills Resources. And for those that you don't know us, we're an oil refiner located in the Rosemont area, just on Highway 52. First of all, I want to let you know that we have been working very closely with the biodiesel board as well as biodiesel manufacturers to make sure that we could get the infrastructure in place. We've invested millions of dollars to make sure that biodiesel can now be blended at our refinery, and have been working towards that goal. As many of you know, the federal government has also moved forward on this, and as a result, refiners have a responsibility now to make sure that we are blending biodiesel as the mandate from the federal government goes forward. So we understand that this is a fuel that is here and a fuel that we're going to be working with, and so we're not here to oppose that at all. What we appreciate is that the author has said he would speak with us. We just have a couple concerns we'd like to address, and we'd like to work with the author as we go through the process to make this work for everybody. One that is most important, because it is our obligation now to provide this type of fuel in our cadre of items that we sell, it's important that we look at all available sources. And so I think, as one of the representatives stated earlier, I think it'd be helpful if we can look at the definition and make sure that the definition is broad enough to encompass some other forms besides just methyl ester. And I think that, particularly as we get into the higher blends, that's going to be important and hopefully something that will be good for everyone, and including the soy farmers as well as other farmers that may have different types of feedstock. We stated in the Biodiesel Task Force, and I think it's a good idea at least to consider, that we should have a technical working group looking at the cold flow properties. I think that as the legislation reflects, many times there are a difference between the summer and winter months. And I know that there is a differential between 15 and 20, but perhaps that differential might be better at 5 and 20. In any event, I think it would be helpful if we had a technical committee that would look at that to ensure that we don't have any cold flow properties. While people have been using B20 many times, it's been when you've had heated garages and other sorts of things. And so I think it would just be helpful in conjunction with both the biodiesel manufacturers as well as refiners, truckers, others that are affected, to have a working group so we can make sure that isn't an ongoing problem. We also believe, as the truckers stated, that we think that any increase over 5%, it would make sense for that to go in front of the legislature as opposed to just going to an outside body. We think that will ensure a larger group of interest and parties taking a look at it. So we would advocate that while you meet the tests that are set forth in the bill, the triggers, that you also would come back before the legislature to take a look at it. I think with that, Madam Chair, what we'd like to say is we'd like to work with the committee members, with the author, to try to see if we can't make this legislation even encompass a few more things that would make it easier for implementation.
Representative Junkie.
That's all I have, Madam Chair. Again, this has got a number of stops along the way. Obviously, we're heading to Commerce and eventually down into Finance Committee, which brings us to the end of March on this, where we have to have it out of there. So it's not done yet, and certainly all the people sitting here will be working with Commissioner Hugesson and myself and Vickerman over in the Senate to make sure that we put together product that we can move out. This isn't put here to be confrontational. I think you've heard that from everyone here today, but rather it's here to be a working product that we can come out with something at the end that is satisfactory for all. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd renew my motion that House File 2987 is amended, be recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Other business, on Thursday, February 21st at 5:30 p.m., Mail Sheet Reception Ag School in Venda Heights. So you're welcome to come, and we can do carpooling or whatever. Just let us know. So thank you. We'll see you Wednesday. Meeting's done.